So this morning, we come to the place where, in an ironic and comical fashion, the tide actually turns in the book of Esther. This is sort of a hinge, chapter 6. So I want to recall the state of affairs at the end of Esther chapter 5. Esther had hosted a banquet for the king and for Haman. Our text opens late on that same night after the banquet. And you'll recall that Esther had requested, dangerously requested, a second banquet for the next day, at which she promised she would tell the king her request. Haman, he had received the counsel of his wife and friends to execute Mordecai, who still refuses to honor him, to execute him on a gallows that he's having constructed this very night. So his plan is to go in and see the king in the morning to seek permission to kill Mordecai. So tomorrow is a critical day. As we noted, the story really slows down here. Tomorrow is a critical day. And unless something beyond human agency happens, Mordecai is likely to be dead even before Esther goes in and pleads with the king for her people. So we'll make 3 points. They're there on page 8 of your bulletin. Sleeplessness, honor, downfall. So first, sleeplessness. This is Esther chapter 6, verse 1. Something beyond human agency does happen. Something trivial, something seemingly incidental, something that appears to have no significance at all. That night, not some other night, right? But of all nights, that night, the king could not sleep. Now, there's a whole theology of sleep in the Bible. You could have a separate short series on it. Sleep as an unearned gift that God gives to his beloved. Sleep as a reminder that our labors are not the decisive thing that makes the world go around. Ever think about that? How much time we spend sleeping in a human life? Sleep as the mystery of a temporary death and type of the resurrection. Right? Sleep, which is the fruit of God's protecting, watching mercies. And it turns out, sleep as something we are not in control of. Anybody who struggles with insomnia knows this. That night, the first event in a chain of coincidences, the king could not sleep. One wonders if something about Esther's very strange approach has gotten under his skin. Why 2 banquets? Why Haman at both banquets? Is she interested in him? Is he interested in her? Are they both interested in seeking some kind of leverage on me? It's not hard imagining a king as paranoid and as fragile as this one, who's already, by the way, been through a thwarted assassination attempt. It's not hard to imagine him getting a little paranoid in this situation. So he cannot sleep. So what does he do? Well, this is the second. I'm going to try and count these. This is the second "it just so happened" link in the chain. Out of all the possibilities that an emperor could do to help himself get back to sleep, he orders that the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, be brought in and read to him. Now, this has got to be material about as interesting as the phone book, right? He's probably thinking, if anything could put me to sleep, this can do it. On the other hand, you could argue that it might feed his narcissism. Probably highly likely that it does, since it's the record of his reign, the memorable deeds of his empire. Maybe it's like, let me go over all the good stuff we've done. And the third link in the chain of coincidences is in verse 2. So this is number 3. It was found, right? Out of all the volumes of Chronicles that could have been selected, the volume brought is this particular volume. That's the third link. And the fourth link is this, and the place that was read to him. Right? If I bring you a volume of, I don't know, 200, 300 pages, what are the odds you're going to turn to the page I want you to? Probably pretty slim. So they bring him the right volume, and then they open it up, and they read to him from the right page. That's at least four coincidences right now lined up. They read where it was found that it was Mordecai who had exposed the assassination plot against the king. And Mordecai was responsible for saving the king, Ahasuerus' life. That was all the way back at the end of chapter 2 in Esther. And we were told there that it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles. And what we said back then was it's going to just sit there like a ticking time bomb in the book. For, you know how long it's been? Something like 4 years. 4 years. Right? So keep good minutes in all these boring meetings, right? We have to keep good minutes. Somebody's going to need the minutes sometime. So we keep minutes. We store them. We archive them. There's a whole guy at the PCA, a whole office at the PCA that does this. So God, the unmentioned agent, he's knitting all these seemingly uninteresting choices together. He doesn't forget. It's been 4 years, but he doesn't forget. The detail is dug out of the archives, mere hours before Mordecai's scheduled to be executed. And the king, he's always loyal to, you know, eager to reward loyalty and to punish disloyalty. He asks this question: what honor has Mordecai received for this? The king's curious about who got the honor, who got the praise, who was acknowledged. He had zero curiosity about executing a genocide under his reign. Didn't ask any questions there. But here he wants to know, this guy did this for me. What did we do to honor him? And his attendants, these young men who are basically sycophants, they say, well, nothing has been done. So you could call this oversight maybe the fifth link in the chain of events that's unfolding. Now, the king, he could be suspicious of Haman's role here, right? He promoted Haman, remember, in the wake of the conspiracy to take his life. He might be thinking, why didn't Haman investigate this matter and reward Mordecai? I mean, Haman's my prime minister, basically. In any event, as we've seen before, this king can never decide what to do. He can't seem to decide for himself. So he asks the men around him, who's in the court? This means it's now the early morning hours. People are showing up for work. So here's the sixth coincidence. Notice the timing. The text tells us, now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace. Right? He entered to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on his gallows, already set up and waiting. Haman is chipper. When this guy gets to work early, he's eager. He's the early bird. He's also an oblivious narcissist, expecting a rubber stamp on his plan, a happy day at work, and then, of course, a delightful banquet later. And the king is told, Haman is standing in the court. And so without a delay, he replies, bring him in. So Haman's probably thinking, well, this is going to be easy. This is going to be over quickly. So that's the sleeplessness. Second, honor. Haman enters, and the king asks him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? Notice, and this is part of the comedy here, the man in view, Mordecai, is not mentioned. The king asks it of an anonymous man, of a hypothetical man, the man whom the king delights to honor. That's like a circumlocution for Mordecai in the rest of the passage. The man whom the king delights to honor. And this, of course, allows Haman to assume that it must be him. Right? He's so vain. He probably thinks this honor's about him. It's hard to know if the king is intentionally setting Haman up, or he just happens innocently to ask the question this way. Either way, the question sets Haman up for a fall. So call the wording of the question the seventh. Is it seven? I don't know. Somebody's keeping track, I hope. That's at least the seventh coincidence in the chain of coincidences. The king happens to ask the question in this bizarre way. tightening the noose around Haman's neck. And you might notice another irony here, a deeper sort of irony in the literary art of Esther, right? Haman, in his vicious little anti-Semitic speech to Ahasuerus about annihilating all the Jews, left the name of the people he wanted to kill out. And now, mysteriously, on the brink of the story's pivoting, the king leaves out the name of the man he wants to honor. And predictably, the text tells us, who is there? This is Haman's thoughts to himself. Who is there that the king would rather honor than me? He's so vain. He probably thinks this honor is about him. Remember, this guy brags about his money. Have you ever looked up the Bible verses about people who brag about their wealth? This guy's one of them. His sons, his successes. And so he jumps to conclusions too quickly, among other things. He's hyper-reactive, Haman, and thin-skinned, right? Awful qualities for someone with this much power. He's also self-indulgent. He has a proclivity to excess. And for him, public honor is his lifeblood. We've already seen this, right? His idol. So he mentions in this text here, Haman mentions, quote, the man whom the king delights to honor four times. He uses the phrase four times in short span. He begins and ends his reply to the king with the phrase. The phrase itself captivates his juvenile, self-absorbed thoughts. So he answers the king's question, and thinking he's the unnamed man, he probably inflates the honor. It's like someone saying, what should be done? You know, how much of a raise should I give you? You're probably going to inflate it a little bit if you think it's you that's getting the raise. And clearly, like, this is something. When you use the term four times, it means it's something you've clearly thought about a lot. Right? You can just picture Haman thinking about, I'm going to get these public honors from the king. So he says this to the king, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. Now, when you ask for the king's own robe and the king's own personal horse, wait, that makes a request like this close to treason. These are the kinds of things that would be given to you if you were ascending to the throne itself. So Haman thinks that equality with the king is something to be grasped. But there's more. For greater honor, the robe and the horse should be entrusted to one of the king's princes or servants. The man should be robed and paraded through the whole city and heralded. Right? You should say in front of him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. He's dreamed of this moment for such a long time because he's so vain. So what does the king say? He says, go at once. Immediately. Hurry. The king commanded, take the robes and the horses and do just as you have said. And do so to Mordecai the Jew. Mordecai the Jew was a term of contempt, right, that Haman used when he was enraged and Mordecai refused to show him honor. You know what it shows here? It shows that Ahasuerus himself is not anti-Semitic. He's perfectly willing to honor publicly, a Jewish subject. Remember, he actually forgot. He doesn't even know who the decree of annihilation is aimed at. Right? He doesn't seem to be aware that Mordecai the Jew would be under the death sentence. And he certainly doesn't know about Haman and Mordecai's feud. Right? So it's kind of like a standard comedic device. It's subtle. But the audience knows more than the parties to the conversation know, right? It's like that Abbott and Costello who's on first routine. Like, we know what's trying to be said, but the people in the bit don't know. They're unaware of it. So he finishes instructing Haman. And he says to him, leave out nothing that you have mentioned. Now, talk about pouring salt in the wound. Make sure you do everything that you've said for Mordecai. So the king's saying to him, hey, this is your deal. Fulfill your word. So Haman obviously here he would be in shock. He finds this a very bitter pill to swallow. He's blindsided. So this is the key reversal in the heart of the book, at the heart of the book. This is the hinge. One commentator says humorously here, the early bird is gotten by the worm. Haman's morning is off to a rough start at work. So Haman gets the robe and the horse, and he dresses Mordecai. Now think about this, right? This is a liturgical inversion, a vestments inversion. Previously, his actions clothed Mordecai in sackcloth and ashes. Here, he invests him with honor. And so the fortunes of the Jews and the fortunes of their enemies turn right here. And then surely with, suppressed rage, he leads Mordecai through the streets, proclaiming the good news in words that would have had a stick in his throat. Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. It's his pride. It's his love of honor. It's his vanity going before his fall. As my final point here is, third point is the downfall. So after this little ride, the text tells us that Mordecai returns to the king's gate. Like he goes back to work. He doesn't think it's time to celebrate because the decree of annihilation is still in effect. But we should notice it, right? There's a kind of beautiful, non-reactive humility and contentment to Mordecai. He gets robed. He gets paraded around the capital city. And he doesn't even seem to entertain vengeance on Haman. It's like he got onto the horse and said, hey, drop me back off where we started. Right? Thanks for the ride. Whatever. You see, he's the opposite of pompous. He just gets dropped off, goes back to the king's gate. Either he's back to work or he's back to sackcloth and ashes and protesting, but he's probably back to work. On the other hand, like Haman is all drama and hysterics. He rushes home in mourning, and now notice this is a key, what I said about this liturgical inversion. His head is covered because he's now in grief. This is the end of the 3 days of fasting and sackcloth and ashes for the Jews. Now their enemies begin to mourn. Again, an astute reader notices this is the pivot, the turning point in the narrative. He runs home in grief, and he tells his wife and friends, that was a collection of rather, shall we say, unwise counselors that we looked at last week. He tells his wife and his friends everything that happened to him. Because it's always about him. Because he's vain. And for this sort of person, he never goes home and says this. I learned a valuable lesson today. They're never broken by providence. They always arrive at Damascus on their horse, unmolested, these people. There's never any heavenly light that knocks them off. They're never picking themselves up out of the dirt trying to figure out what went on. They just always go right through it, and they arrive at Damascus, seated on their horse, unmolested. The world is full of these kinds of people. You would think they would make some sort of course correction, or there'd be some sort of self-examination, or some sort of humility. Not with this guy. That's not what happens. It's always somebody else's fault. And his advisors, who gave him the monstrous advice the day before about executing Mordecai, surprisingly, they speak like they're Gentile prophets here. They say this. In fact, the contrast is so stark, it causes trouble for commentators. They're not sure, could this possibly be the same set of people? It seems like it is. And his wife, Zeresh, is in both scenes. They say, if Mordecai before whom you have begun to fall. Now, this is not literally true politically, but they can see it coming. They say, since Mordecai is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. They may remember, right, with the Gentile prophet Balaam, who was also from the east, remember? Balaam said the God of Israel would triumph over the Amalekites. And Haman is an Amalekite. Maybe they know that Balaam story. Or at the very least, they probably know the Abrahamic promise that those who bless Abraham's seed will be blessed, those who curse it will be cursed. In any event, their own words, the words of his friends now, they confirm Mordecai's own words to Esther way back in chapter 4, where he said, if you refuse, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from some other quarter. And again, God is not mentioned here. But it's quite remarkable that there is, right, in the upper rungs of Persian power, there's a kind of deep-seated fear or belief that you cannot oppose the covenant people without coming to ruin. One can imagine Haman saying to his friends, what? You knew all this and you said nothing to me when I issued a decree to slaughter all the Jews? I mean, think about that. Or yesterday, it would have been nice if yesterday you told me this when you knew Mordecai was a Jew and I suggested that we execute him. That's why his advisors are virtually prophesying here. This doesn't seem to be the normal mode of counsel, you know, that Haman gets in his inner circle. It's an extraordinary scene, right, with these Persians agreeing with Mordecai that some mysterious, some unknown, some unnamed, some hidden but potent force will come to the aid of the people of God. And while they're talking, the king's eunuchs arrive and they whisk. He's taken, because he's passive now, a passive Haman to the feast with Esther. She's in charge, the feast that she had prepared. So Haman, he may not know what's in store now, but he does know this. He knows the gallows he built will not be occupied by Mordecai. And he knows that his fall from power has begun. So never, right, has the old song, "What a Difference a Day Makes," been truer than in the last day of this story. Not even 24 hours, probably 8 to 10 hours. So I want to make 3 points in closing. The first one is their honor, action, consequences. First, honor. It's important to see that Mordecai is moving. He's being transfigured from a righteous man, suffering and unrecognized, anonymous, if you will, to one vindicated, to one exalted, to one publicly recognized. He doesn't grasp after power or the kingship, yet honor comes to him. And we should see here the humiliation and the exaltation of the Lord Jesus Christ in the pattern that's in front of us in Mordecai's life. He's an icon of Christ in this text. He did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, and now he's exalted. He is the man God, the king, chooses to honor. He is the son in whom God is well pleased. Right? And this, again, is ultimately fulfilled concretely in Jesus Christ, who emptied himself and is now honored by God. Remember, Jesus is the one who rode not on the king's horse, but on a donkey in lowliness. And Jesus was robed, but mockingly dressed in purple robes of royalty. And he had a crown, but his crown was of twisted thorns. And in lowly pomp, he rides on in public to die. If you will, the greater Mordecai. He was scheduled for execution by the empire, and it's a gallows that Jesus was not delivered from. And now he rides on in triumph, clothed, invested in with royal majesty, right? The seed of Abraham, Jesus the Jew, the son in whom God is pleased to honor. And honor how? Not just in the capital of Susa, but being proclaimed universally, publicly to the ends of the earth. And you and I are called into union with that Jesus, and thus with that way of being in the world. Right, to be united to this one is to be summoned into this way of being, meaning the way of losing our lives to save them. We saw this in the gospel lesson. Of not grasping for honor, of not grasping for power, but of emptying ourselves in service, in waiting in dishonor for honor to be given. The apostles in Acts chapter 5, after they're imprisoned and beaten, are released. And they make the most remarkable statement. They say they were honored to be dishonored. That's following in the footsteps of Jesus. That's what is happening to Mordecai, and ultimately, of course, to Christ, and finally to you and I. So that's honor. The second thing is action. One crucial lesson of the text of the whole book, really, is that our action, as important as it is, and I've already said human action has a place in this book. It is important. But it's important to see it's not operating our action on the same level as God's action. It's not like we split the pie up, right? Human action. God works through means. That's true. He works through your actions. But our confession of faith in chapter 5 on providence says that God can work without or above or against means anytime he chooses. And he does that with ease. So while your actions matter, you're a moral agent and you'll be accountable to God for your actions, it's very important to see this. We are not needed. We are honored to be called into a kind of cooperation with the divine design. But notice what is happening in this text. The story turns here where Esther and Mordecai are both absent or passive. Nothing about their boldness enters into the scene. You know that chain of seven coincidences? It had nothing to do with either one of them. Mordecai triumphs on this night while he is sleeping. Isn't that astounding? You got all this drama in the book of Esther, all this terror, all these political machinations, and the guy conquers while he's asleep. It reminds me of the statement of Luther when they asked him, "What did you do to make the Reformation so successful?" And he said, "I slept. The Word did it all." And they pressed him, of course, and he said, "Well, I preached the Word. I drank beer with the saints, and while I was sleeping, the Reformation happened." He got something of the fact that his actions mattered, but God did something that transcended his action. Right? Mordecai is sleeping. Esther's plan with the two banquets and all that stuff, it's not even gotten off the ground. Has no role in the scene other than to set some timing markers. God saves the Jews by disturbing the sleep of the king, having the exact right boring text brought to him. Effortlessly, without our aid, he is able to save. Mordecai's sackcloth and ashes and his public pressure, right? And Esther's quiet diplomacy have no place in the scene. They do nothing here. So situations in human life, both, they do two things. They both evoke our actions. We must act. But in evoking human action, they relativize it, to at least to a Christian who understands the world. Because God can do whatever he wants while we're sleeping. He doesn't need Mordecai and Esther to be heroes. And if you read the book that way, you're going to miss something very profound. In any event, they'd be deeply flawed heroes. The hero is the secret providence of God. So this chapter reminds us that God's actions and our actions are not correlated. We are not God's equal partners. His actions are decisive. He can save the world while you're asleep. Finally, then, coincidences. Somebody once said that a coincidence is just God's way of remaining anonymous. He is, if you will, masked and subtle. But the text indicates that the most mundane, the most, if you will, unspiritual things, the most boring, this worldly regularities, these things, the anonymous, silent God is ordering for your sake. There's a mysterious depth, right? A strange design in the ordinary stuff. And we need to be alert to it. You're not going to be able to grasp it or see it all, but, you know, it's something to be keyed into a bit. The details are divine appointments. Here, the future history of the world turns on one sleepless night. It could be a commonplace encounter. It could be an interruption. An emergency, a phone call, an email, a chance event, a quiet moment. God's providence is almost entirely tiny little things. Your life is 98 point something little stuff. A word, a look, a tone of voice, some body language, some errands, some daily disciplines, some maintenance, some upkeep, some work, eat, sleep, repeat. That's just what life is. Frederick Faber, the hymn writer, said this: "Thrice blessed is he to whom is given the instinct that can tell that God is on the field when he is most invisible." Yes, he's rhyming tell with invisible. But, you know, he's a hymn writer. He gets... So let me read it again. Keep that in mind. Tell and invisible are being rhymed. But it's a beautiful couplet. Thrice blessed is he to whom is given the instinct that can tell that God is on the field when he is most invisible. That's an instinct that a lot of us don't have, to know that God is on the field when he seems the most absent. Let us cultivate that instinct, right? That sense of God's fatherly hand measuring out our daily portion, ordering our steps, right? That instinct means this God is present in sovereign, invisible wisdom and goodness in all that befalls us, right? And the mirror of this redeeming providence is Jesus Christ himself, the man, the son, whom the king delights to honor. Amen. Amen.